Side 4, 2010, Odyssey 2, continuing on page 149. He realized that it was not one but multitudes, and that whatever measuring instruments might say, it was always the same size, as large as necessary. How obvious now was that mathematical ratio of its sides, the quadratic sequence 1 to 4 to 9, and how naive to have imagined that the series ended there, in only three dimensions. Even as his mind focused upon these geometrical simplicities, the empty rectangle filled with stars, the hotel suite, if indeed it had ever really existed, dissolved back into the mind of its creator, and there before him was the luminous whirlpool of the galaxy. It might have been some beautiful, incredibly detailed model embedded in a block of plastic, but it was the reality, now grasped by him as a whole with senses more subtle than vision. If he wished, he could focus his attention upon any one of its 100 billion stars. Here he was, adrift in this great river of suns, halfway between the banked fires of the galactic core and the lonely scattered sentinel stars of the rim. And there was his origin, on the far side of this chasm in the sky, this serpentine band of darkness, empty of all stars. He knew that this formless chaos, visible only by the glow that limned its edges from fire mists far beyond, was the still unused stuff of creation, the raw material of evolutions yet to be. Here time had not yet begun, not until the suns that now burned were long since dead would light and life reshape this void. Unwittingly, he had crossed it once, now far better prepared, though still wholly ignorant of the impulse that drove him. He must cross it again. The galaxy burst forth from the mental frame in which he had enclosed it. Stars and nebulae poured past him in an illusion of infinite speed. Phantom suns exploded and fell behind as he slipped like a shadow through their cores. The stars were thinning out, the glare of the Milky Way dimming into a pale ghost of the glory he had known and might one day know again. He was back in the space that men called real, at the very point he had left it, seconds or centuries ago. He was vividly aware of his surroundings and far more conscious than in that earlier existence of a myriad sensory inputs from the external world. He could focus upon any one of them and scrutinize it in virtually limitless detail until he confronted the fundamental granular structure of time and space below which there was only chaos. And he could move, though he did not know how. But had he ever really known that, even when he possessed a body? The chain of command from brain to limb was a mystery to which he had never given any thought. An effort of will, and the spectrum of that nearby star shifted toward the blue by precisely the amount he wished. He was falling toward it at a large fraction of the speed of light. Though he could go faster if he desired, he was in no hurry. There was still much information to be processed, much to be considered, and much more to be won. That, he knew, was his present goal, but he also knew that it was only part of some far wider plan to be revealed in due course. He gave no thought to the gateway between universes dwindling so swiftly behind him, or to the anxious entities gathered around it in their primitive spacecraft. They were part of his memories, but stronger ones were calling him now, calling him home to the world he had never thought to see again. He could hear its myriad voices growing louder and louder, as it too was growing from a star almost lost against the sun's outstretched corona to a slim crescent and finally to a glorious blue-white disk. They knew that he was coming. Down there on that crowded globe, the alarms would be flashing across the radar screens, the great tracking telescopes would be searching the skies, and history as men had known it would be drawing to a close. 1,000 kilometers below, he became aware that a slumbering cargo of death had awakened and was stirring in its orbit. The feeble energies it contained were no possible menace to him. Indeed, he could profitably use them. He entered the maze of circuitry and swiftly traced the way to its lethal core. Most of the branchings could be ignored. They were blind alleys devised for protection. Beneath his scrutiny, their purpose was childishly simple. It was easy to bypass them all. Now there was a single last barrier, a crude but effective mechanical relay holding apart two contacts. Until they were closed, there would be no power to activate the final sequence. He put forth his will, and for the first time knew failure and frustration. The few grams of the micro-switch would not budge. He was still a creature of pure energy. As yet, the world of inert matter was beyond his grasp. Well, there was a simple answer to that. He still had much to learn. The current pulse he induced in the relay was so powerful that it almost melted the coil before it could operate the trigger mechanism. The microseconds ticked slowly by. It was interesting to observe the explosive lenses focus their energies like the feeble match that ignites a powder train, which, in turn, the megatons flowered in a silent detonation that brought a brief false dawn to half the sleeping world. Like a phoenix rising from the flames, he absorbed what he needed and discarded the rest. Far below, the shield of the atmosphere, which protected the planet from so many hazards, absorbed the most dangerous of the radiation. But there would be some unlucky men and animals who would never see again. In the aftermath of the explosion, it seemed as if the Earth was struck dumb. The babble of the short and medium waves was completely silenced, reflected back by the suddenly enhanced ionosphere. Only the microwaves still sliced through the invisible and slowly dissolving mirror that now surrounded the planet, and most of these were too tightly beamed for him to receive them. A few high-powered radars were still focused upon him, but that was a matter of no importance. He did not even bother to neutralize them, as he could easily have done. And if any more bombs were to come his way, he would treat them with equal indifference. For the present, he had all the energy he needed. And now he was descending in great sweeping spirals toward the lost landscape of his childhood. Chapter 31, Disneyville. A fin de siècle philosopher had once remarked, and been roundly denounced for his pains, that Walter Elias Disney had contributed more to genuine human happiness than all the religious teachers in history. Now, half a century after the artist's death, his dreams were still proliferating across the Florida landscape. When it had opened in the early 1980s, his experimental prototype community of tomorrow had been a showcase for new technologies and modes of living. But as its founder had realized, Epcot would only fulfill its purpose when some of its vast acreage was a genuine living town, occupied by people who called it home. That process had taken the remainder of the century. Now the residential area had 20,000 inhabitants and had, inevitably, become popularly known as Disneyville. Because they could move in only after penetrating a palace guard of WED lawyers, it was not surprising that the average age of the occupants was the highest in any United States community, or that its medical services were the most advanced in the world. Some of them, indeed, could hardly have been conceived, still less created, in any other place. The apartment had been carefully designed not to look like a hospital suite, and only a few unusual fittings would have betrayed its purpose. The bed was scarcely knee-high so that the danger of falls was minimized. It could, however, be raised and tilted for the convenience of the nurses. The bathroom tub was sunk into the floor and had a built-in seat as well as handrails, so that even the elderly or infirm could get in and out of it easily. The floor was thickly carpeted, but there were no rugs over which one could trip, or sharp corners that might cause injuries. Other details were less obvious, and the TV camera was so well concealed that no one would have suspected its presence. There were few personal touches, a pile of old books in one corner and a framed front page of one of the last printed issues of the New York Times proclaiming U.S. spaceship leaves for Jupiter. Close to this were two photographs, one showing a boy in his late teens, the other a considerably older man wearing astronaut's uniform. Though the frail gray-haired woman watching the domestic comedy unfolding on the TV panel was not yet 70, she looked much older. From time to time, she chuckled appreciatively at some joke from the screen, but she kept glancing at the door as if expecting a visitor. And when she did so, she took a firmer grasp on the walking stick propped against her chair. Yet she was distracted by a moment of TV drama when the door finally opened and she looked around with a guilty start as the little service trolley rolled into the room, followed closely by a uniformed nurse. "Time for lunch, Jesse," called the nurse. "We've got something very nice for you today." "Don't want any lunch." "It will make you feel a lot better." "I won't eat until you tell me what it is." "Why won't you eat it?" "I'm not hungry." "Are you ever hungry?" she added slyly. The robot food trolley came to a halt beside the chair, and the transport covers opened up to reveal the dishes. Throughout, the nurse never touched anything, not even the controls on the trolley. She now stood motionless with a rather fixed smile, looking at her difficult patient. In the monitor room, 50 meters away, the medical technician said to the doctor, "Now watch this." Jesse's gnarled hand lifted the walking stick. Then, with surprising speed, she swept it in a short arc toward the nurse's legs. The nurse took no notice whatsoever, even when the stick sliced right through her. Instead, she remarked soothingly, "Now doesn't that look nice? Eat it up, dear." A cunning smile spread across Jesse's face, but she obeyed instructions. In a moment, she was eating heartily. "You see," said the technician, "she knows perfectly well what's going on. She's a lot brighter than she pretends to be, most of the time."
"And she's the first?"
"Yes, all the others believe that really is Nurse Williams bringing their meals."
"Well, I don't think it matters.
Look how pleased she is just because she's outsmarted us. She's eating her food, which is the purpose of the exercise. But we must warn the nurses, all of them, not just Williams."
"Why, oh, of course. The next time it may not be a hologram. And then think of the lawsuits we'll be facing from our battered staff."
Chapter 32, Crystal Spring. The Indians and the Cajun settlers who had moved here from Louisiana said that Crystal Spring was bottomless. That, of course, was nonsense, and surely even they could not believe it. One had only to put on a face mask and swim out a few strokes, and there, clearly visible, was the little cave from which the incredibly pure water flowed with the slender green weeds undulating around it, and peering up through them, the eyes of the monster. Two dark circles, side by side, even though they never moved, what else could they be? That lurking presence gave an added excitement to every swim. One day the monster would come rushing up from its lair, scattering the fish in its hunt for larger prey. Never would Bobby or David admit that nothing more dangerous than an abandoned and doubtless stolen bicycle lay half buried among the water weeds 100 meters down. That depth was hard to believe, even after line and sinker had established it beyond argument. Bobby, the older and better diver, had been perhaps a tenth of the way down and had reported that the bottom looked just as far away as ever. But now the Crystal Spring was about to reveal its secrets. Perhaps the legend of the Confederate treasure was true, despite the scorn of all the local historians. At the very least, they might endear themselves to the chief of police, always excellent policy, by recovering a few handguns deposited after recent crimes. The little air compressor that Bobby had found in the garage junk heap was now chugging healthily away after their initial problems of starting it. Every few seconds it would cough and emit a cloud of blue smoke, but it showed no sign of stopping. "And even if it does," said Bobby, "so what? If the girls in the underwater theater can swim up from 50 meters without their air hoses, so can we. It's perfectly safe." "In that case," thought Dave fleetingly, "why didn't we tell Ma what we were doing, and why did we wait until Dad had gone back to the Cape for the next shuttle launch?" But he did not have any real qualms. Bobby always knew best. It must be wonderful to be 17 and to know everything. Though he wished he wouldn't spend quite so much time now with that stupid Betty Schultz. True, she was very pretty, but damn it, she was a girl. It was only with the greatest difficulty that they had been able to get rid of her this morning. Dave was used to being a guinea pig. That was what younger brothers were for. He adjusted his face mask, put on his flippers, and slid into the crystalline water. Bobby handed him the air hose with the old scuba mouthpiece they had taped to it. Dave took a breath and grimaced. "It tastes horrible. You'll get used to it. In you go, no deeper than that ledge. That's where I'll start adjusting the pressure valve so we don't waste too much air. Come up when I tug the hose." Dave slid gently beneath the surface and into Wonderland. It was a peaceful monochrome world, so different from the coral reefs of the Keys. There were none of the garish colors of the marine environment, where life, animal and vegetable, flaunted itself with all the hues of the rainbow. Here were only delicate shades of blue and green and fish that looked like fish, not like butterflies. He flippered slowly down, dragging the hose behind him, pausing to drink from its stream of bubbles whenever he felt the need. The sensation of freedom was so wonderful that he almost forgot the horrible oily taste in his mouth. When he reached the ledge, actually an ancient waterlogged tree trunk so overgrown with weeds that it was unrecognizable, he sat down and looked around him. He could see right across the spring to the green slopes at the far side of the flooded crater, at least 100 meters away. There were not many fish around, but a small school went twinkling past like a shower of silver coins in the sunlight streaming down from above. There was also an old friend stationed, as usual, at the gap where the waters of the spring began their journey to the sea. A small alligator, but large enough, Bobby had once said cheerfully, he's bigger than I am, was hanging vertically without visible means of support, only his nose above the surface. They had never bothered him, and he had never bothered them. The air hose gave an impatient tug. Dave was happy to go. He had not realized how cold it could get at that hitherto unattainable depth, and he was also feeling distinctly sick. But the hot sunlight soon revived his spirits. No problem, said Bobby expansively. Just keep unscrewing the valve so the pressure gauge doesn't drop below the red line. How deep are you going? All the way, if I feel like it. Dave did not take that seriously. They both knew about rapture of the depths and nitrogen narcosis. And in any case, the old garden hose was only 30 meters long. That would be plenty for this first experiment. As he had done so many times before, he watched with envious admiration as his beloved elder brother accepted a new challenge. Swimming as effortlessly as the fish around him, Bobby glided downward into that blue, mysterious universe. He turned once and pointed vigorously to the air hose, making it unmistakably clear that he needed an increased airflow. Despite the splitting headache that had suddenly come upon him, Dave remembered his duty. He hurried back to the ancient compressor and opened the control valve to its deadly maximum, 50 parts per million of carbon monoxide. The last he saw of Bobby was that confidently descending, sunlight-dappled figure passing forever beyond his reach. The wax statue in the funeral parlor was a total stranger, who had nothing to do with Robert Bowman. Chapter 33, Betty. Why had he come here, returning like an unquiet ghost to the scene of ancient anguish? He had no idea. Indeed, he had not been conscious of his destination until the round eye of Crystal Spring had gazed up at him from the forest below. He was master of the world, yet he was paralyzed by a sense of devastating grief he had not known for years. Time had healed the wound, as it always does, yet it seemed only yesterday that he had stood weeping beside the emerald mirror, seeing only the reflections of the surrounding cypresses with their burden of Spanish moss. What was happening to him? And now, still without deliberate volition, but as if swept by some gentle current, he was drifting northward toward the state capital. He was looking for something. What it was, he would not know until he found it. No one and no instrument detected his passage. He was no longer radiating wastefully, but had almost mastered his control of energy, as once he had mastered lost, though not forgotten, limbs. He sank like a mist into the earthquake-proof vaults until he found himself among billions of stored memories and dazzling, flickering networks of electronic thoughts. This task was more complex than the triggering of a crude nuclear bomb and took him a little longer. Before he found the information he was seeking, he made one trivial slip but did not bother to correct it. No one ever understood why the next month 300 Florida taxpayers, all of whose names began with F, received checks for precisely $1. It cost many times the overpayment to straighten matters out, and the baffled computer engineers finally put the blame on a cosmic ray shower, which on the whole was not so very far from the truth. In a few milliseconds he had moved from Tallahassee to 634 South Magnolia Street, Tampa. It was still the same address. He need not have wasted time looking it up. But then he had never intended to look it up until the very moment when he had done so. After 3 births and 2 abortions, Betty Fernandez, née Schultz, was still a beautiful woman. At the moment, she was also a very thoughtful one. She was watching a TV program that brought back memories, bitter and sweet. It was a news special, triggered by the mysterious events of the preceding 12 hours, beginning with the warning that Leonov had beamed back from the moons of Jupiter. Something was heading for Earth. Something had, harmlessly, detonated an orbiting nuclear bomb which no one had come forward to claim. That was all, but it was quite enough. The news commentators had dredged up all the old videotapes, and some of them really were tapes, going back to the once top-secret records showing the discovery of TMA-1 on the moon. For the 50th time, at least, she heard that eerie radio shriek as the monolith greeted the lunar dawn and hurled its message toward Jupiter. And once again she watched the familiar scenes and listened to the old interviews aboard Discovery. Why was she watching? It was all stored somewhere in the home archives, though she never played it back when Jose was around. Perhaps she was expecting some news flash. She did not like to admit even to herself how much power the past still held over her emotions. And there was Dave, as she had expected. It was an old BBC interview, of which she knew almost every word. He was talking about Hal, trying to decide whether the computer was self-conscious or not. How young he looked. How different from those last blurred images from the doomed Discovery. And how much like Bobby as she remembered him. The image wavered as her eyes filled with tears. No, something was wrong with the set or the channel. Both sound and image were behaving erratically. Dave's lips were moving, but she could hear nothing. Then his face seemed to dissolve, to melt into blocks of color. It reformed, blurred again, and then was steady once more. But there was still no sound. Where had they got this picture? This was not Dave as a man, but as a boy, as she had known him first. He was looking out of the screen, almost as if he could see her across the gulf of years. He smiled. His lips moved. "Hello, Betty," he said. It was not hard to form the words and to impose them on the currents pulsing in the audio circuits. The real difficulty was to slow down his thoughts to the glacial tempo of the human brain, and then to have to wait an eternity for the answer. Betty Fernandez was tough. She was also intelligent, and though she had been a housewife for a dozen years, she had not forgotten her training as an electronics service person. This was just another of the medium's countless miracles of simulation. She would accept it now and worry about the details later. "Dave," she answered. "Dave, is that really you?" "I am not sure," replied the image on the screen in a curiously toneless voice. "But I remember Dave Bowman and everything about him."
"Is he dead?"
Now that was another difficult question. His body, yes. But that is no longer important. All that Dave Bowman really was is still part of me. Betty crossed herself. That was a gesture she had learned from Jose, and whispered,
"You mean you're a spirit?"
"I do not know a better word."
"Why have you returned?"
"Ah, Betty, why indeed? I wish you could tell me." Yet he knew one answer, for it was appearing on the TV screen. The divorce between body and mind was still far from complete, and not even the most complacent of the cable networks would have transmitted the blatantly sexual images that were forming there now. Betty watched for a little while, sometimes smiling, sometimes shocked. Then she turned away, not through shame, but sadness. Regret for lost delights.
"So it's not true," she said, "what they always told us about angels."
"Am I an angel?" he wondered. But at least he understood what he was doing there, swept back by the tides of sorrow and desire to a rendezvous with his past. The most powerful emotion he had ever known had been his passion for Betty. The elements of grief and guilt it contained only made it stronger. She had never told him if he was a better lover than Bobby. That was one question he had never asked, for that would have broken the spell. They had clung to the same illusions, sought in each other's arms. And how young he had been, still only 17, when it had started, barely 2 years after the funeral. A balm for the same wound. Of course it could not last, but the experience had left him irrevocably changed. For more than a decade, all his auto-erotic fantasies had centered upon Betty. He had never found another woman to compare with her, and long ago had realized that he never would. No one else was haunted by the same beloved ghost. The images of desire faded from the screen. For a moment, the regular program broke through with an incongruous shot of Leonov hanging above Io. Then Dave Bowman's face reappeared. He seemed to be losing control, for its lineaments were wildly unstable. Sometimes he would seem only 10 years old, then 20 or 30, then incredibly a wizened mummy whose wrinkled features were a parody of the man she had once known. "I have one more question before I go,"
Carlos, you always said he was Jose's son, and I always wondered, what was the truth? Betty Fernandez stared for one long last time into the eyes of the boy she had once loved. He was 18 again, and for a moment she wished she could see his entire body, not merely his face.
He was your son, David, she whispered.
The image faded, the normal service resumed. When, almost an hour later, Jose Fernandez came quietly into the room, Betty was still staring at the screen. She did not turn around as he kissed her on the back of the neck.
You'll never believe this, Jose.
Try me.
I've just lied to a ghost.
Chapter 34, Valediction.
When the American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics published its controversial summary, 50 Years of UFOs, in 1997, many critics pointed out that unidentified flying objects had been observed for centuries, and that Kenneth Arnold's flying saucer sighting of 1947 had countless precedents. People had been seeing strange things in the sky since the dawn of history, but until the mid-20th century, UFOs were a random phenomenon of no general interest. After that date, they became a matter of public and scientific concern, and the basis for what could only be called religious beliefs. The reason was not far to seek. The arrival of the giant rocket and the dawn of the space age had turned men's minds to other worlds. Realization that the human race would soon be able to leave the planet of its birth prompted the inevitable questions. Where's everyone? And when may we expect visitors? There was also the hope, though it was seldom spelled out in as many words, that benevolent creatures from the stars might help mankind heal its numerous self-inflicted wounds and save it from future disasters. Any student of psychology could have predicted that so profound a need would be swiftly satisfied. During the last half of the 20th century, there were literally thousands of reports of spacecraft sightings from every part of the globe. More than that, there were hundreds of reports of close encounters, actual meetings with extraterrestrial visitors, frequently embellished by tales of celestial joyrides, abductions, and even honeymoons in space. The fact that over and over again these were demonstrated to be lies or hallucinations did nothing to deter the faithful. Men who had been shown cities on the far side of the moon lost little credibility, even when orbiter surveys and Apollo missions revealed no artifacts of any kind. Ladies who married Venusians were still believed when that planet sadly turned out to be hotter than molten lead. By the time the AIAA published its report, no reputable scientist, even among those few who had once espoused the idea, believed that UFOs had any connection with extraterrestrial life or intelligence. Of course, it would never be possible to prove that. Any one of those myriad sightings over the last 1,000 years might have been the real thing. But as time went by and satellite cameras and radars scanning the entire heavens produced no concrete evidence, the general public lost interest in the idea. The cultists, of course, were not discouraged but kept the faith with their newsletters and books, most of them regurgitating and embellishing old reports long after they had been discredited or exposed. When the discovery of the Tycho monolith, TMA-1, was finally announced, there was a chorus of "I told you so's." It could no longer be denied that there had been visitors to the moon, and presumably to the Earth as well, a little matter of 3 million years ago. At once UFOs infested the heavens again, though it was odd that the three independent national tracking systems, which could locate anything in space larger than a ballpoint pen, were still unable to find them. Rather quickly, the number of reports dropped down to the noise level once more, the figure that would be expected merely as a result of the many astronomical, meteorological, and aeronautical phenomena constantly occurring in the skies. But now it had started all over again. This time there was no mistake. It was official. A genuine UFO was on its way to Earth. Sightings were reported within minutes of the warning from Leonov. The first close encounters were only a few hours later. A retired stockbroker walking his bulldog on the Yorkshire moors was astonished when a disc-shaped craft landed beside him and the occupant, quite human except for the pointed ears, asked the way to Downing Street. The contactee was so surprised that he was only able to wave his stick in the general direction of Whitehall. Conclusive proof of the meeting was provided by the fact that the bulldog now refused to take his food.
Although the stockbroker had no previous history of mental illness, even those who believed him had some difficulty in accepting the next report. This time it was a Basque shepherd on a traditional mission. He was greatly relieved when what he had feared to be border guards turned out to be a couple of cloaked men with piercing eyes who wanted to know the way to the United Nations headquarters. They spoke perfect Basque, an excruciatingly difficult tongue with no affinity to any other known language of mankind. Clearly the space visitors were remarkable linguists, even if their geography was oddly deficient. So it went on, case after case. Very few of the contactees were actually lying or insane. Most of them sincerely believed their own stories and retained that belief even under hypnosis. And some were just victims of practical jokes or improbable accidents, like the unlucky amateur archaeologists who found the props that a celebrated science fiction movie maker had abandoned in the Tunisian desert almost four decades earlier. Yet only at the beginning, and at the very end, was any human being genuinely aware of his presence, and that was because he so desired it. The world was his to explore and examine as he pleased, without restraint or hindrance. No walls could keep him out, no secrets could be hidden from the senses he possessed. At first he believed that he was merely fulfilling old ambitions by visiting the places he had never seen in that earlier existence. Not until much later did he realize that his lightning-like sallies across the face of the globe had a deeper purpose. In some subtle way, he was being used as a probe, sampling every aspect of human affairs. The control was so tenuous that he was barely conscious of it. He was rather like a hunting dog on a leash, allowed to make excursions of his own, yet nevertheless compelled to obey the overriding wishes of his master. The pyramids, the Grand Canyon, the moon-washed snows of Everest, these were choices of his own. So were some art galleries and concert halls, though he would certainly, on his own initiative, never have endured the whole of the ring. Nor would he have visited so many factories, prisons, hospitals, a nasty little war in Asia, a race course, a complicated orgy in Beverly Hills, the Oval Room of the White House, the Kremlin Archives, the Vatican Library, the sacred black stone of the Kaaba at Mecca. There were also experiences of which he had no clear memory, as if they had been censored, or he was being protected from them by some guardian angel. For example, what was he doing at the Leakey Memorial Museum in Oldoway Gorge? He had no greater interest in the origin of man than any other intelligent member of the species H. sapiens, and fossils meant nothing to him. Yet the famous skulls, guarded like crown jewels in their display cases, aroused strange echoes in his memory, and an excitement for which he was unable to account. There was a feeling of déjà vu stronger than any he had ever known. The place should be familiar, but something was wrong. It was like a house to which one returns after many years to find that all the furniture has been changed, the walls moved, and even the stairways rebuilt. It was bleak, hostile terrain, dry and parched. Where were the lush plains and the myriad fleet-footed herbivores that had roamed across them 3 million years ago? 3 million years. How had he known that? No answer came from the echoing silence into which he had thrown the question, but then he saw, once more looming before him, a familiar black rectangular shape. He approached, and a shadowy image appeared in its depths, like a reflection in a pool of ink. The sad and puzzled eyes that stared back from beneath that hairy receding forehead looked beyond him into a future they could never see. For he was that future, 100,000 generations further down the stream of time. History had begun there, that at least he now understood. But how, and above all, why, were secrets still withheld from him? But there was one last duty, and that was hardest of all. He was still sufficiently human to put it off until the very end. "Now what's she up to?" the duty nurse asked herself, zooming the TV monitor onto the old lady. "She's tried lots of tricks, but this is the first time I've seen her talking to her hearing aid, for goodness sake. I wonder what she's saying." The microphone was not sensitive enough to pick up the words, but that scarcely seemed to matter. Jesse Bowman had seldom looked so peaceful and content. Though her eyes were closed, her entire face was wreathed in an almost angelic smile while her lips continued to form whispered words. And then the watcher saw something that she tried hard to forget, because to report it would instantly disqualify her in the nursing profession. Slowly and jerkily, the comb lying on the bedside table raised itself in the air as if lifted by clumsy, invisible fingers. On the first attempt, it missed. Then, with obvious difficulty, it began to part the long silver strands, pausing sometimes to disentangle a knot. Jessie Bowman was not speaking now, but she continued to smile. The comb was moving with more assurance and no longer in abrupt, uncertain jerks. How long it lasted, the nurse could never be certain. Not until the comb was gently replaced on the table did she recover from her paralysis. 10-year-old Dave Bowman had finished the chore, which he always hated, but which his mother loved. And to David Bowman, who was now ageless, had gained his first control of obdurate matter. Jessie Bowman was still smiling when the nurse finally came to investigate. She had been too scared to hurry, but it would have made no difference anyway. Chapter 35, Rehabilitation. The uproar of Earth was comfortably muted across the millions of kilometers of space. Leonov's crew watched with fascination, yet with a certain detachment, the debates in the United Nations, the interviews with distinguished scientists, the theorizing of the news commentators, the matter-of-fact yet wildly conflicting accounts of the UFO contactees. They could contribute nothing to the brouhaha, for they had witnessed no further manifestations of any kind. Zagadka, alias Big Brother, remained as blankly indifferent to their presence as ever, and that was indeed an ironic situation. They had come all the way from Earth to solve a mystery, and it looked as if the answer might be right back at their starting point. For the first time, they felt grateful for the slow velocity of light and the two-hour delay that made live interviews impossible on the Earth-Jupiter circuit. Even so, Floyd was badgered by so many media requests that he finally went on strike. Nothing more remained to be said, and he had said it at least a dozen times. Besides, there was still much work to be done. Leonov had to be prepared for the long journey home, so that it would be ready to depart immediately when the launch window opened. The timing was not at all critical. Even if they missed by a month, that would merely prolong the trip. Chandra, Kurnow, and Floyd would not even notice as they slept their way toward the sun. But the rest of the crew was grimly determined to leave just as soon as the laws of celestial mechanics permitted. Discovery still posed many problems. The ship had barely sufficient propellant for the return to Earth, even if it left much later than Leonov, and flew a minimum energy orbit, which would take almost 3 years. And this would be possible only if HAL could be reliably programmed to carry out the mission with no human intervention except long-range monitoring. Without his cooperation, Discovery would have to be abandoned once again. It had been fascinating, indeed deeply moving, to watch the steady regrowth of HAL's personality, from brain-damaged child to puzzled adolescent and at length to slightly condescending adult. Although he knew that such anthropomorphic labels were highly misleading, Floyd found it quite impossible to avoid them. And there were times when he felt that the whole situation had a haunting familiarity. How often he had seen video dramas in which disturbed youngsters were straightened out by all-wise descendants of the legendary Sigmund Freud. Essentially the same story was being played out in the shadow of Jupiter. The electronic psychoanalysis had proceeded at a speed totally beyond human comprehension as repair and diagnostic programs flashed through HAL's circuits at billions of bits a second, pinpointing possible malfunctions and correcting them. Though most of these programs had been tested in advance on HAL's twin, Sal 9000, the impossibility of a real-time dialogue between the two computers was a serious handicap. Sometimes hours were wasted when it proved necessary to check back with Earth at a critical point in the therapy. For despite all Chandra's work, the computer's rehabilitation was still far from complete. HAL exhibited numerous idiosyncrasies and nervous tics, sometimes even ignoring spoken words, though he would always acknowledge keyboard inputs from anyone. In the reverse direction, his outputs were even more eccentric. There were times when he would give verbal replies, but would not display them visually. At other times, he would do both, but refuse to print hard copy. He would give no excuses or explanations, not even the stubbornly impenetrable "I prefer not to" of Melville's autistic scrivener, Bartleby. However, he was not actively disobedient so much as reluctant, and only where certain tasks were concerned. It was always possible to win his cooperation eventually, to talk him out of his sulk, as Curnow put it neatly. It was not surprising that Dr. Chandra was beginning to show the strain. On one celebrated occasion when Max Brilovsky innocently revived an old canard, he almost lost his temper. "Is it true, Dr. Chandra, that you chose the name HAL to be one step ahead of IBM?"
"Utter nonsense. Half of us come from IBM, and we've been trying to stamp out that story for years. I thought that by now every intelligent person knew that HAL is derived from heuristic algorithmic."
Afterward, Max swore that he could distinctly hear the capital letters. In Floyd's private opinion, the odds were at least 50-1 against flying Discovery safely back to Earth. And then Chandra came to him with an extraordinary proposal.
"Dr. Floyd, can I have a word with you?"
After all the weeks and shared experiences, Chandra was still as formal as ever, not only to Floyd, but to all the crew. He would not even address the ship's baby, Xenia, without the prefix ma'am.
"Of course, Chandra. What is it?"
"I've virtually completed the programming for the 6 most probable variations on the Hohmann return orbit.
5 have now been run on a simulation without any problems."
"Excellent. I'm sure that no one else on Earth, in the solar system, could have done it."
"Thank you. However, you know as well as I do that it's impossible to program for every eventuality. HAL may, will, function perfectly, and will be able to handle any reasonable emergency. But all sorts of trivial accidents, minor equipment failures that could be fixed with a screwdriver, broken wires, stuck switches, could leave him helpless and abort the whole mission."
"You're absolutely right, of course, and it's been worrying me. But what can we do about it?"
"It's really quite simple. I'd like to stay with Discovery."
Floyd's immediate reaction was that Chandra had gone crazy. On second thought, perhaps he was only half crazy. It might indeed make all the difference between success and failure to have a human being, that superb all-purpose troubleshooting and repair device, aboard Discovery for the long voyage back to Earth. But the objections were completely overwhelming.
"It's an interesting idea," Floyd answered with extreme caution, "and I certainly appreciate your enthusiasm. But have you thought of all the problems?"
That was a silly thing to say. Chandra would have all the answers already filed away for immediate retrieval.
"You'll be on your own for over 3 years. Suppose you had an accident or a medical emergency."
"That's a risk I'm prepared to take."
"And what about food, water? Leonov doesn't have enough to spare."
"I've checked Discovery's recycling system. It can be made operational again without too much difficulty. Besides, we Indians can manage on very little."
It was unusual for Chandra to refer to his origins or indeed to make any personal statements. His true confession was the only example Floyd could remember. But he did not doubt the claim. Curnow had once remarked that Dr. Chandra had the sort of physique that could only be achieved by centuries of starvation. Although it sounded like one of the engineer's unkinder wisecracks, it had been made entirely without malice, indeed with sympathy, though not, of course, in Chandra's hearing.
"Well, we still have several weeks to decide. I'll think it over and talk to Washington."
"Thank you. Do you mind if I start making the arrangements?"
Not at all, as long as they don't interfere with the existing plans. Remember, Mission Control will have to make the final decision."
And I know exactly what Mission Control will say. It was madness to expect a man to survive in space for 3 years, alone. But, of course, Chandra had always been alone.
Chapter 36, Fire in the Deep.
Earth was already far behind, and the awesome wonders of the Jovian system were expanding swiftly before him when he had his revelation. How could he have been so blind, so stupid? It was as if he had been walking in his sleep. Now he was starting to awaken. "Who are you?" he cried. "What do you want? Why have you done this to me?" There was no answer, yet he was certain that he had been heard. He sensed a presence, even as a man can tell, though his eyes are tightly shut, that he is in a closed room and not some empty open space. Around him there was the faint echo of a vast mentality, an implacable will. He called again into the reverberant silence, and again there was no direct reply, only that sense of watchful companionship. Very well, he would find the answers for himself. Some were obvious,
whoever or whatever they were interested in mankind. They had tapped and stored his memories for their own inscrutable purposes. And now they had done the same with his deepest emotions, sometimes with his cooperation, sometimes without. He did not resent that. Indeed, the very processing he had experienced made such childish reactions impossible. He was beyond love and hate and desire and fear, but he had not forgotten them and could still understand how they ruled the world of which he had once been part. Was that the purpose of the exercise? If so, for what ultimate goal? He had become a player in a game of gods and must learn the rules as he went along. The jagged rocks of the four tiny outer moons, Sinope, Pasiphae, Carmi, and Ananke, flickered briefly across his field of consciousness. Then came Elaera, Lasithia, Himalia, and Leda at half their distance from Jupiter. He ignored them all. Now the pockmarked face of Callisto lay ahead. Once, twice, he orbited the battered globe larger than Earth's own moon, while senses of which he had been unaware probed its outer layers of ice and dust. His curiosity was quickly satisfied. This world was a frozen fossil, still bearing the marks of collisions that, eons ago, must have come close to shattering it. One hemisphere was a giant bullseye, a series of concentric rings where solid rock had once flowed in kilometer-high ripples under some ancient hammer blow from space. Seconds later, he was circling Ganymede. Now there was a far more complex and interesting world. Though so near to Callisto and almost the same size, it presented an utterly different appearance. There were, it was true, numerous craters, but most of them seemed to have been quite literally plowed back into the ground. The most extraordinary feature of the Ganymedean landscape was the presence of meandering stripes, built up from scores of parallel furrows a few kilometers apart. This grooved terrain looked as if it had been produced by armies of intoxicated plowmen, weaving back and forth across the face of the satellite. In a few revolutions, he saw more of Ganymede than all the space probes ever sent from Earth and filed away the knowledge for future use. One day it would be important, he was sure of that, though he did not know why, any more than he understood the impulse that was now driving him so purposefully from world to world. As presently it brought him to Europa. Though he was still largely a passive spectator, he was aware now of a rising interest, a focusing of attention, a concentration of will, even if he was a puppet in the hands of an unseen and uncommunicative master. Some of the thoughts of that controlling influence leaked, or were allowed to leak, into his own mind. The smooth, intricately patterned globe now rushing toward him bore little resemblance either to Ganymede or Callisto. It looked organic. The network of lines branching and intersecting over its entire surface was uncannily like a world-spanning system of veins and arteries. The endless ice fields of a frigid waste, far colder than the Antarctic, stretched beneath him. Then, with brief surprise, he saw that he was passing over the wreckage of a spaceship. He recognized it instantly as the ill-fated Tien, featured in so many of the video newscasts he had analyzed. Not now. Not now. There would be ample opportunity later. Then he was through the ice and into a world as unknown to his controllers as to himself. It was an ocean world, its hidden waters protected from the vacuum of space by a crust of ice. In most places, the ice was kilometers thick, but there were lines of weakness where it had cracked open and torn apart. Then there had been a brief battle between two implacably hostile elements that came into direct contact on no other world in the solar system. The war between sea and space always ended in the same stalemate. The exposed water simultaneously boiled and froze, repairing the armor of ice. The seas of Europa would have frozen completely solid long ago without the influence of nearby Jupiter. Its gravity continually kneaded the core of the little world. The forces that convulsed Io were working there, though with much less ferocity. As he skimmed across the face of the deep, he saw everywhere the evidence of that tug of war between planet and satellite. And he both heard and felt it in the continual roar and thunder of submarine earthquakes, the hiss of escaping gases from the interior, the infrasonic pressure waves of avalanches sweeping over the abyssal plains. By comparison with the tumultuous ocean that covered Europa, even the noisy seas of Earth were silent. He had not lost his sense of wonder.
and the first oasis filled him with delighted surprise. It extended for almost a kilometer around a tangled mass of pipes and chimneys deposited by mineral brines gushing from the interior. Out of that natural parody of a Gothic castle, black scalding liquids pulsed in a slow rhythm as if driven by the beating of some mighty heart. And like blood, they were the authentic sign of life itself. The boiling fluids drove back the deadly cold leaking down from above and formed an island of warmth on the seabed. Equally important, they brought from Europa's interior all the chemicals of life. There, in an environment where none had expected it, were energy and food in abundance. Yet it should have been expected. He remembered that, only a lifetime ago, such fertile oases had been discovered in the deep oceans of Earth. Here they were present on an immensely larger scale and in far greater variety. In the tropical zone, close to the contorted walls of the castle, were delicate, spidery structures that seemed to be the analogy of plants, though almost all were capable of movement. Crawling among these were bizarre slugs and worms, some feeding on the plants, others obtaining their food directly from the mineral-laden waters around them. At greater distances from the source of heat, the submarine fire around which all the creatures warmed themselves were sturdier, more robust organisms, not unlike crabs or spiders. Armies of biologists could have spent lifetimes studying that one small oasis. Unlike the Paleozoic terrestrial seas, it was not a stable environment, so evolution had progressed swiftly here, producing multitudes of fantastic forms, and they were all under indefinite stay of execution. Sooner or later, each fountain of life would weaken and die as the forces that powered it moved their focus elsewhere. Again and again in his wanderings across the European seabed, he encountered the evidence of such tragedies. Countless circular areas were littered with the skeletons and mineral-encrusted remains of dead creatures, where entire chapters of evolution had been deleted from the Book of Life. He saw huge empty shells formed like convoluted trumpets as large as a man. There were clams of many shapes, bivalves and even trivalves, and there were spiral stone patterns many meters across which seemed an exact analogy of the beautiful ammonites that disappeared so mysteriously from Earth's oceans at the end of the Cretaceous period. Searching, seeking, he moved back and forth over the face of the abyss. Perhaps the greatest of all the wonders he met was a river of incandescent lava flowing for 100 kilometers along a sunken valley. The pressure at that depth was so great that the water in contact with the red-hot magma could not flash into steam, and the two liquids coexisted in an uneasy truce. There, on another world and with alien actors, something like the story of Egypt had been played long before the coming of man. As the Nile had brought life to a narrow ribbon of desert, so this river of warmth had vivified the European deep. Along its banks, in a band never more than 2 kilometers wide, species after species had evolved and flourished and passed away, and at least one had left a monument behind it. At first he thought that it was merely another of the incrustations of mineral salts that surrounded almost all the thermal vents. However, as he came closer, he saw that it was not a natural formation, but a structure created by intelligence, or perhaps by instinct. On Earth, the termites reared castles that were almost equally imposing, and the web of a spider was more exquisitely designed. The creatures that had lived there must have been quite small, for the single entrance was only half a meter wide. That entrance, a thick-walled tunnel made by heaping rocks on top of each other, gave a clue to the builder's intentions. They had reared a fortress there in the flickering glow not far from the banks of their molten Nile, and then they had vanished. They could not have left more than a few centuries before. The walls of the fortress, built from irregularly shaped rocks that must have been collected with great labor, were covered with only a thin crust of mineral deposits. One piece of evidence suggested why the stronghold had been abandoned. Part of the roof had fallen in, perhaps owing to the continual earthquakes, and in an underwater environment, a fort without a roof was wide open to an enemy. He encountered no other sign of intelligence along the river of lava. Once, however, he saw something uncannily like a crawling man, except that it had no eyes and no nostrils, only a huge toothless mouth that gulped continuously, absorbing nourishment from the liquid medium around it. Along the narrow band of fertility in the deserts of the deep, whole cultures and even civilizations might have risen and fallen,
Armies might have marched or swum under the command of European Tamerlanes or Napoleons, and the rest of their world would never have known. For all those oases of warmth were as isolated from one another as the planets themselves. The creatures who basked in the glow of the lava river and fed around the hot vents could not cross the hostile wilderness between their lonely islands. If they had ever produced historians and philosophers, each culture would have been convinced that it was alone in the universe. Yet even the space between the oases was not altogether empty of life. There were hardier creatures who had dared its rigors. Often swimming overhead were the European analogues of fish, streamlined torpedoes propelled by vertical tails, steered by fins along their bodies. The resemblance to the most successful dwellers in Earth's oceans was inevitable. Given the same engineering problems, evolution must produce very similar answers. As witness the dolphin and the shark, superficially almost identical, yet from far distant branches of the tree of life. There was, however, one very obvious difference between the fish of the European seas and those in terrestrial oceans. They had no gills, for there was hardly a trace of oxygen to be extracted from the waters in which they swam. Like the creatures around Earth's own geothermal vents, their metabolism was based on sulfur compounds present in abundance in the near volcanic environment. And very few had eyes. Apart from the flickering glow of the rare lava outpourings and occasional bursts of bioluminescence from creatures seeking mates or hunters questing prey, it was a lightless world. It was also a doomed one. Not only were its energy sources sporadic and constantly shifting, but the tidal forces that drove them were steadily weakening. Even if they developed true intelligence, the Europans must perish with the final freezing of their world. They were trapped between fire and ice. Chapter 37. Estrangement.
I'm truly sorry, old friend, to be the bearer of such bad news. But Caroline has asked me, and you know how I feel about you both. And I don't think it can be such a surprise. Some of the remarks you've made to me over the last year have hinted at it, and you know how bitter she was when you left Earth. No, I don't believe there's anyone else. If there was, she'd have told me. But sooner or later, well, she's an attractive young woman. Chris is fine, and of course he doesn't know what's happening. At least, he won't be hurt. He's too young to understand, and children are incredibly elastic. Just a minute, I'll have to key my thesaurus. Ah, resilient. Now, to things that may seem less important to you. Everyone is still trying to explain that bomb detonation as an accident, but of course nobody believes it. Because nothing else has happened, the general hysteria has died down. We're left with what one of your commentators has called the looking-over-the-shoulder syndrome. And someone has found a 100-year-old poem that sums up the situation so neatly that everybody's quoting it. It's set in the last days of the Roman Empire, at the gates of a city whose occupants are waiting for invaders to arrive. The emperor and dignitaries are all lined up in their most costly togas, ready with speeches of welcome. The Senate has closed because any laws it passes today will be ignored by the new masters. Then, suddenly, a dreadful piece of news arrives from the frontier. There aren't any invaders. The reception committee breaks up in confusion. Everyone goes home, muttering disappointedly, "Now what will happen to us?" Those people were a kind of solution. There's just one slight change needed to bring the poem up to date. It's called Waiting for the Barbarians, and this time we are the barbarians. And we don't know what we're waiting for, but it certainly hasn't arrived. One other item. Had you heard that Commander Bowman's mother died only a few days after the thing came to Earth? It does seem an odd coincidence, but the people at her nursing home say that she never showed the slightest interest in the news, so it couldn't possibly have affected her. Floyd switched off the recording. Dimitri was right. He was not taken by surprise, but that made not the slightest difference. It hurt just as badly. Yet what else could he have done? If he had refused to go on the mission, as Caroline had so clearly hoped, he would have felt guilty and unfulfilled for the remainder of his life. That would have poisoned his marriage. Better this clean break when physical distance softened the pain of separation. Or did it? In some ways, it made things worse.
More important was duty and the sense of being part of a team devoted to a single goal. So Jesse Bowman was gone. Perhaps that was another cause for guilt. He'd helped to steal her only remaining son, and that must have contributed to her mental breakdown. Inevitably, he was reminded of a discussion that Walter Kernow had started on that very subject.
"Why did you choose Dave Bowman? He always struck me as a cold fish. Not actually unfriendly, but whenever he came into the room, the temperature seemed to drop 10 degrees.
That was one of the reasons we did select him. He had no close family ties except for a mother he didn't see very often, so he was the sort of man we could send on a long, open-ended mission.
How did he get that way?
I suppose the psychologists could tell you.
I did see his report, of course, but that was a long time ago.
There was something about a brother who was killed, and his father died soon afterward in an accident on one of the early shuttles. I'm not supposed to tell you this, but it certainly doesn't matter now.
It didn't matter, but it was interesting.
Now Floyd almost envied David Bowman, who had come to that very spot, a free man unencumbered by emotional ties with Earth. No, he was deceiving himself. Even while the pain gripped his heart like a vice, what he felt for David Bowman was not envy, but pity.
Chapter 38, Foamscape. The last beast he saw before he left the oceans of Europa was much the largest. It closer resembled one of the banyan trees from Earth's tropics, whose scores of trunks allow a single plant to create a small forest, sometimes covering hundreds of square meters. The specimen, however, was walking, apparently on a trek between oases. If it was not one of the creatures that had destroyed Tien, it certainly belonged to a very similar species. Now he had learned all that he needed to know. Or rather, all that they needed to know. It was one more moon to visit. Seconds later, the burning landscape of Io lay below him. It was as he had expected. Energy and food were there in abundance. But the time was not yet ripe for their union. Around some of the cooler sulfur lakes, the first steps had been taken on the road to life. But before any degree of organization had occurred, all such bravely premature attempts were thrown back into the melting pot. Not until the tidal forces that drove Io's furnaces had lost their power, millions of years hence, would there be anything to interest biologists on this seared and sterilized world. He wasted little time on Io, and none at all on the tiny inner moons that skirted Jupiter's ghostly rings, themselves only pale shadows of the glory that was Saturn's. The greatest of worlds lay before him. He would know it as no man had ever done, or ever would. The million-kilometer-long tendrils of magnetic force, the sudden explosions of radio waves, the geysers of electrified plasma wider than the planet Earth, they were as real and clearly visible to him as the clouds banding the planet in multi-hued glory. He could understand the complex pattern of their interactions and realize that Jupiter was much more wonderful than anyone had ever guessed. Even as he fell through the roaring heart of the great red spot, with the lighting of its continent-wide thunderstorms detonating around him, he knew why it had persisted for centuries, though it was made of gases far less substantial than those that formed the hurricanes of Earth. The thin scream of hydrogen wind faded as he sank into the calmer depths, and a sleet of waxen snowflakes, some already coalescing into barely palpable mountains of hydrocarbon foam, descended from the heights above. It was already warm enough for liquid water to exist, but there were no oceans there. This purely gaseous environment was too tenuous to support them. He descended through layer after layer of cloud until he entered a region of such clarity that even human vision could have scanned an area more than 1,000 kilometers across. It was only a minor eddy in the vaster gyre of the great red spot, and it held a secret that man had long guessed but never proved. Skirting the foothills of the drifting foam mountains were myriads of small, sharply defined clouds, all about the same size and patterned with similar red and brown mottlings. They were small only as compared with the inhuman scale of their surroundings. The very least would have covered a fair-sized city. They were clearly alive, for they were moving with slow deliberation along the flanks of the aerial mountains, browsing off their slopes like colossal sheep. And they were calling to each other in the meter band, their radio voices faint but clear against the cracklings and concussions of Jupiter itself.
Nothing less than living gas bags, they floated in the narrow zone between freezing heights and scorching depths. Narrow, yes, but a domain far larger than all the biosphere of Earth. They were not alone. Moving swiftly among them were other creatures, so small that they could easily have been overlooked. Some of them bore an almost uncanny resemblance to terrestrial aircraft and were of about the same size. But they, too, were alive, perhaps predators, perhaps parasites, perhaps even herdsmen. A whole new chapter of evolution, as alien as that which he had glimpsed on Europa, was opening before him. There were jet-propelled torpedoes like the squids of the terrestrial oceans, hunting and devouring the huge gas bags. But the balloons were not defenseless. Some of them fought back with electric thunderbolts and with clawed tentacles like kilometer-long chainsaws. There were even stranger shapes, exploiting almost every possibility of geometry. Bizarre, translucent kites, tetrahedra, spheres, polyhedra, tangles of twisted ribbons. The gigantic plankton of the Jovian atmosphere, they were designed to float like gossamer in the uprising currents until they had lived long enough to reproduce. Then they would be swept down into the depths to be carbonized and recycled in a new generation. He was searching a world more than 100 times the area of Earth, and though he saw many wonders, nothing there hinted of intelligence. The radio voices of the great balloons carried only simple messages of warning or of fear. Even the hunters, who might have been expected to develop higher degrees of organization, were like the sharks in Earth's oceans, mindless automata. And for all its breathtaking size and novelty, the biosphere of Jupiter was a fragile world, a place of mists and foam, of delicate silken threads and paper-thin tissues spun from the continual snowfall of petrochemicals formed by lightning in the upper atmosphere. Few of its constructs were more substantial than soap bubbles. Its most terrifying predators could be torn to shreds by even the feeblest of terrestrial carnivores. Like Europa, on a vastly grander scale, Jupiter was an evolutionary cul-de-sac. Consciousness would never emerge here. Even if it did, it would be doomed to a stunted existence. A purely aerial culture might develop, but in an environment where fire was impossible and solid scarcely existed, it could never even reach the Stone Age. And now, as he hovered above the center of a Jovian cyclone merely as large as Africa, he became aware once again of the presence controlling him. Moods and emotions were leaking into his own consciousness, though he could not identify any specific concepts or ideas. It was as if he were listening, outside a closed door, to a debate in progress, and in a language he could not understand. But the muffled sounds clearly conveyed disappointment, then uncertainty, then a sudden determination, though for what purpose he could not tell. Once again, he felt like a pet dog, able to share his master's changing moods, but not to comprehend them. And then the invisible leash was taking him down toward the heart of Jupiter. He was sinking through the clouds below the level where any form of life was possible. Soon he was beyond the reach of the last rays from the faint and distant sun. The pressure and temperature were swiftly mounting. Already it was above the boiling point of water, and he passed briefly through a layer of superheated steam. Jupiter was like an onion. He was peeling it away, skin by skin, though as yet he had traveled only a fraction of the distance to its core. Beneath the steam was a witch's brew of petrochemicals, enough to power for 1 million years all the internal combustion engines that mankind had ever built. It became thicker and denser. Then, quite abruptly, it ended at a discontinuity only a few kilometers thick. Heavier than any rocks on Earth, yet still a liquid, the next shell consisted of silicon and carbon compounds of a complexity that could have provided lifetimes of work for terrestrial chemists. Layer followed layer for thousands of kilometers, but as the temperature rose into the hundreds and then the thousands of degrees, the composition of the various strata became simpler and simpler. Halfway down to the core, it was too hot for chemistry. All compounds were torn apart, and only the basic elements could exist. Next there came a deep sea of hydrogen, but not hydrogen as it had ever existed for more than a fraction of a second in any laboratory on Earth. This hydrogen was under such enormous pressure that it had become a metal. He had almost reached the center of the planet, but Jupiter had one more surprise in store. The thick shell of metallic yet still fluid hydrogen ended abruptly. At last there was a solid surface, 60,000 kilometers down. For ages, the carbon, baked out of the chemical reactions far above, had been drifting down toward the center of the planet. There it had gathered, crystallizing at a pressure of millions of atmospheres. And there, by one of nature's supreme jests, was something very precious to mankind. The core of Jupiter, forever beyond human reach, was a diamond as big as the Earth. Chapter 39, In the Pod Bay.
Walter, I'm worried about Haywood.
I know, Tanya, but what can we do?
Kurnow had never seen Commander Orlova in so indecisive a mood. It made her seem much more appealing, despite his prejudice against small women.
I'm very fond of him, but that's not the reason. His, I suppose, gloom is the best word for it, is making everyone miserable. Leonov has been a happy ship. I want to keep it that way.
Why don't you talk to him? He respects you, and I'm sure he'll do his best to snap out of it.
I intend to do just that.
And if it doesn't work, well,
there's one simple solution. What more can he do on this trip? When we start back for home, he'll be in hibernation anyway. We could always, what do you say, jump the gun on him.
Phew, the same dirty trick that Katerina played on me. He'd be mad when he woke up.
But also safely back on Earth and very busy. I'm sure he'd forgive us.
I don't think you're serious.
Even if I backed you up, Washington would raise hell. Besides, suppose something happened and we really need him badly.
Isn't there a 2-week buffer period before you can revive anyone safely?
At Haywood's age, more like a month. Yes, we'd be committed. But what do you think could happen now? He's done the job he was sent for, apart from keeping an eye on us. And I'm sure you've been well briefed about that in some obscure suburb of Virginia or Maryland.
I neither confirm nor deny, and frankly, I'm a lousy undercover agent. I talk too much, and I hate security. I fought all my life to keep my rating below restricted. Every time there was danger of being reclassified confidential, or worse still, secret, I'd go and create a scandal. Though that's getting very difficult nowadays.
Walter, you're incorrupt...
Incorrigible?
Yes, that's the word I meant. But back to Haywood, please. Would you like to talk to him first?
You mean, give him a pep talk? I'd rather help Katerina drive in the needle. Our psychologies are too different. He thinks I'm a loud-mouthed clown,
which you often are, but that's only to hide your real feelings. Some of us have evolved the theory that deep down inside you is a really nice person struggling to get out.
For once, Kurnow was at a loss for words. Finally, he mumbled, "Oh, very well, I'll do my best. But don't expect miracles. My profile gave me Z for tact."
Where's he hiding at the moment?
In the pod bay. He claims he's working on his final reports, but I don't believe it. He just wants to get away from us all, and that's the quietest place.
That was not the reason, though it was indeed an important one.
Unlike the carousel, where most of the action aboard Discovery was then taking place, the pod bay was a zero-G environment.
Right at the beginning of the space age, man had discovered the euphoria of weightlessness and remembered the freedom they had lost when they left the ancient womb of the sea.
Beyond gravity, some of that freedom was regained. With the loss of weight went many of the cares and worries of Earth. Haywood Floyd had not forgotten his sorrow, but it was more bearable here. When he was able to look at the matter dispassionately, he was surprised at the strength of his reaction to an event not wholly unexpected. More than loss of love was involved. Though that was the worst part. The blow had come when he was particularly vulnerable, at the very moment when he was feeling a sense of anticlimax, even futility. And he knew precisely why. He had achieved all that he had been expected to do, thanks to the skill and cooperation of his colleagues. He was letting them down, he knew, by his present selfishness. If all went well, that litany of the space age, they would return to Earth with a cargo of knowledge that no expedition had ever gathered before. And a few years later, even the once-lost Discovery would be restored to her builders. It was not enough. The overpowering enigma of Big Brother remained out there, only a few kilometers away, mocking all human aspirations and achievements. Just as its analog on the moon had done a decade ago, it had come to life for a moment, then relapsed into stubborn inertness. It was a closed door upon which they had hammered in vain. Only David Bowman, it seemed, had ever found the key. Perhaps that explained the attraction he felt for this quiet and sometimes even mysterious place. From here, from that now empty launch cradle Bowman had left on his last mission,
through the circular hatchway that led to infinity. He found the thought exhilarating rather than depressing. Certainly it helped to distract him from his personal problems. Nina's vanished twin was part of the history of space exploration. It had traveled, in the words of the hoary old cliché that always evoked a smile, yet an acknowledgement of its fundamental truth, where no man had gone before. Where was it now? Would he ever know? He would sometimes sit for hours in the crowded but not cramped little capsule, trying to collect his thoughts and occasionally dictating notes. The other crew members respected his privacy and understood the reason for it. They never came near the pod bay and had no need to do so. Its refurbishment was a job for the future and some other team. Once or twice, when he had felt really depressed, he found himself thinking, suppose I ordered Hal to open the pod bay doors and set out along Dave Bowman's trail. Would I be greeted by the miracle he saw and which Vasily glimpsed a few weeks ago? It would solve all my problems. Even if the thought of Chris did not deter him, there was an excellent reason why so suicidal a move was out of the question. Nina was a very complex piece of equipment. He could no more operate her than fly a fighter aircraft. He was not meant to be an intrepid explorer. That particular fantasy would remain unrealized. Walter Kernow had seldom undertaken a mission with more reluctance. He felt genuinely sorry for Floyd, but at the same time a little impatient with the other's distress. His own emotional life was broad but shallow. He had never put all his eggs in one basket. More than once he had been told that he spread himself too thin, and though he had never regretted it, he was beginning to think it was time to settle down. He took the shortcut through the carousel control center, noting that the maximum speed reset indicator was still flashing idiotically. A major part of his job was deciding when warnings could be ignored, when they could be dealt with at leisure, and when they had to be treated as real emergencies. If he paid equal attention to all the ship's cries for help, he would never get anything done. He drifted along the narrow corridor that led to the pod bay, propelling himself by occasional flicks against the rungs on the tubular wall. The pressure gauge claimed that there was vacuum on the other side of the airlock door, but he knew better. It was a fail-safe situation. He could not have opened the lock if the gauge were telling the truth. The bay looked empty now that two of the three pods had long since gone. Only a few emergency lights were operating, and on the far wall one of Hal's fisheye lenses was regarding him steadily. Kernow waved to it but did not speak. At Chandra's orders, all audio inputs were still disconnected except for the one that only he used. Floyd was sitting in the pod with his back to the open hatch, dictating some notes, and he swung slowly around at Kernow's deliberately noisy approach. For a moment the two men regarded each other in silence, then Kernow announced portentously, "Dr. H. Floyd, I bear greetings from our beloved captain. She considers it high time you rejoined the civilized world." Floyd gave a wan smile, then a little laugh. "Please return my compliments. I'm sorry I've been unsociable. I'll see you all at the next 6 o'clock Soviet." Kernow relaxed. His approach had worked. Privately, he considered Floyd something of a stuffed shirt and had the practical engineer's tolerant contempt for theoretical scientists and bureaucrats. Since Floyd ranked high in both categories, he was an almost irresistible target for Kernow's sometimes peculiar sense of humor. Nevertheless, the two men had grown to respect and even admire each other. Thankfully, changing the subject, Kernow rapped on Nina's brand new hatch cover, straight from the spares store and contrasting vividly with the rest of the space pod's shabby exterior. "I wonder when we'll send her out again," he said. "And who's going to ride in her this time? Any decisions?" "No, Washington got cold feet. Moscow says let's take a chance, and Tanya wants to wait. What do you think?" "I agree with Tanya. We shouldn't interfere with Zagadka until we're ready to leave. If anything goes wrong then, that should improve the odds slightly." Kernow looked thoughtful and unusually hesitant. "What is it?" asked Floyd, sensing his change of mood. "Don't ever give me away," but Max was thinking of a little one-man expedition. "I can't believe he was serious. He wouldn't dare. Tanya would have him clapped in irons." "That's what I told him, more or less." "I'm disappointed. I thought he was a little more mature. After all, he is 32. 31. Anyway, I talked him out of it. I reminded him that this was real life, not some stupid video drama where the hero sneaks out into space without telling his companions and makes the big discovery. Now it was Floyd's turn to feel a little uncomfortable. After all, he had been thinking on similar lines.
Are you sure he won't try anything?
200% sure. Remember your precautions with Hal? I've already taken steps with Nina. Nobody flies her without my permission.
I still can't believe it.
Are you sure Max wasn't pulling your leg?
His sense of humor isn't that subtle. Besides, he was pretty miserable at the time.
Oh, now I understand. It must have been when he had that row with Xenia. I suppose he wanted to impress her. Anyway, they seem to have gotten over it.
I'm afraid so, Curnow answered wryly.
Floyd could not help smiling. Curnow noticed it and started to chuckle, which made Floyd laugh, which... It was a splendid example of positive feedback in a high-gain loop. Within seconds, they were both laughing uncontrollably. The crisis was over. What was more, they had taken the first step toward genuine friendship. They had exchanged vulnerabilities. Chapter 40. Daisy, Daisy. The sphere of consciousness in which he was embedded enclosed the whole of Jupiter's diamond core. He was dimly aware at the limits of his new comprehension that every aspect of the environment around him was being probed and analyzed. Immense quantities of data were being gathered, not merely for storage and contemplation, but for action. Complex plans were being considered and evaluated. Decisions were being made that might affect the destiny of worlds. He was not yet part of the process, but he would be.
Now you are beginning to understand.
It was the first direct message. Though it was remote and distant like a voice through a cloud, it was unmistakably intended for him. Before he could ask any of the myriad questions that raced through his mind, there was a sense of withdrawal, and once more he was alone. But only for a moment. Closer and clearer came another thought, and for the first time he realized that more than one entity was controlling and manipulating him. He was involved in a hierarchy of intelligences, some close enough to his own primitive level to act as interpreters. Or perhaps they were all aspects of a single being. Or perhaps the distinction was totally meaningless. Of one thing, however, he was now sure. He was being used as a tool, and a good tool had to be sharpened, modified, adapted. And the very best tools were those that understood what they were doing. He was learning that now. It was a vast and awesome concept, and he was privileged to be a part of it, even though he was aware of only the merest outlines. He had no choice but to obey, yet that did not mean that he must acquiesce to every detail, at least without a protest. He had not yet lost all his human feelings that would have made him valueless. The soul of David Bowman had passed beyond love, but he could still know compassion for those who had once been his colleagues.
Very well, came the answer to his plea.
He could not tell whether the thought conveyed an amused condescension or total indifference, but there was no doubt of its majestic authority as it continued,
They must never know that they are being manipulated. That would ruin the purpose of the experiment.
Then there was a silence that he did not wish to breach again. He was still awed and shaken, as if for a moment he had heard the clear voice of God. Now he was moving purely under his own volition, toward a destination he had chosen himself. The crystal heart of Jupiter fell below. The layers upon layers of helium and hydrogen and carbonaceous compounds flickered past. He had a glimpse of a great battle between something like a jellyfish, 50 kilometers across, and a swarm of spinning disks that moved more swiftly than anything he had yet seen in the Jovian skies. The jellyfish appeared to be defending itself with chemical weapons. From time to time, it would emit jets of colored gas, and the disks, touched by the vapor, would start to wobble drunkenly and slip downward like falling leaves until they had disappeared from sight. He did not stop to watch the outcome. He knew now that it did not matter who were the victors and who the vanquished. As a salmon leaps a waterfall, he flashed in seconds from Jupiter to Io against the descending electric currents of the flux tube. It was quiescent today. Only the power of a few terrestrial thunderstorms was flowing between planet and satellite. The gateway through which he had returned still floated in that current, shouldering it aside as it had done since the dawn of man. And there, utterly dwarfed by the monument of a greater technology, was the vessel that had brought him from the little world of his birth. How simple, how crude it now appeared. With a single scan, he could see innumerable flaws and absurdities in its design, as well as that of the slightly less primitive ship to which it was now coupled by a flexible, airtight tube. It was hard to focus upon the handful of entities inhabiting the two ships. He could barely interact with the soft creatures of flesh and blood who drifted like ghosts through the metal corridors and cabins.